The Right to Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
What is Nash's crushology book?
I had a friend in high school who sort of kept a journal of the guys that she had a crush on. And it wasn't quite as elaborate as the one I described for Nash. There weren't illustrations, and it wasn't quite as intentional for this friend of mine. But with Nash, I feel like he's the kind of person who would internalize a lot of that stuff because he didn't have anyone else to relate to. And so he was experiencing those crushes, sort of the arc of those of each of those crushes, almost as a story or a work of art for himself, and hoping that eventually those mini arcs would add up to a big arc that would get him the love he was hoping for.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Spokane, Washington author Chris Denison about her debut YA novel, You and Me and Him.
The narrator of You and Me and Him is Maggie Bauer, an overweight 17-year-old from a small town in northwest Washington state. She's fully aware of her low social status in the high school's hierarchy, and yet she really has a pretty good sense of self. Her self-esteem is good. Why is that?
You know, in a lot of ways, Maggie and I had a lot of the same experiences in high school, and Maggie is sort of the teenager I wish I could have been. One of the things I wanted to accomplish in the book was writing a book where who we are on the outside or whatever the most significant thing we think about ourselves isn't the only thing about ourselves. And so, you know, for Maggie, it's her weight. For Nash, it's being gay. For Stacy, it's being popular. All of those different people have sort of this one defining quality. And yet we all know that all of us are a lot of different things. And so to not sort of pigeonhole people based on that one quality. And so I needed Maggie to know that a little bit, even though she evolves in that knowledge throughout the book. I needed her to understand that about herself just a little bit from the start.
As you just said, your characters are not one-dimensional. They have lots of qualities. Was that how it was for you writing this? Did you put yourself a little bit in each character?
Oh, yeah, I definitely think there's things. I mean, I'm a parent as well. You know, I mean, I say Maggie is a little bit of what I wish I'd been in high school, but I'm also, you know, there's a little bit of me in each of the parents and a little bit of me maybe in Quinn because I was a teacher for 17 years. And so I had some of those same kinds of conversations and relationships with some of the kids I worked with. There's definitely that real longing that Nash has for that romantic connection. That was completely me in high school. I had that in a big way. And also the Stacy part where she feels like everyone has these expectations of her that if she doesn't meet them, that she'll be sort of cast out of the tribe. I related to that. I moved halfway through my junior year in high school, so some of Tom's experiences were, you know, I sort of connected to that character. So definitely I think there's a lot of points of connection for me in each character.
Well, your story begins on the first day of everyone's junior year in high school, and that's in chapter one. Do you mind just reading that for us?
Sure. Let's get one thing straight from the very beginning. I'm not one of those shrinking violet fat girls. I don't sit alone in my bedroom playing Billie Holiday albums while drowning my sorrows in a carton of ice cream. Okay, once, maybe twice a year, but not every weekend. I have friends, a great job in a vintage record store, and even some minor social status. But I am an overweight teenage girl going to an American high school. It doesn't take a clairvoyant to figure out there are going to be some issues. The current issue, which outfit will maximize the 4.5 pounds I lost this summer and minimize the remaining flesh. As usual, my mom's annual summer diet plan for me didn't result in any magical transformations, so for the debut of my junior year, I decide on my flowy hippie chick skirt and a black t-shirt with sleeves too long for the heat of early September. I don't love this outfit, but it fits, kind of, and it's not hideous. Most of the clothes in my size look like they were designed for retirees in Miami Beach, Florida. I do not like my shirts bedazzled in any way. Someone in the plus-size fashion industry thinks if you put shiny stuff on a t-shirt, no one will notice the size of the person underneath. This particular first day outfit is nothing tragic, but it's more of a fashion whisper than a fashion statement. I climb on the bus and make a beeline for Nash. Maggie! He gives me a slight wave, then covers it by smoothing down his rockabilly sideburns. He grooms them, no lie, with mustache wax. I slide into the seat beside him. Nash shifts upward as the seat sags in my direction. Move your skinny ass over, I say. Like my skinny ass has a choice? He moves. Nice skirt. Nash squinches up his face like something smells bad. I sigh. Nash is all about edgy, and my 60s Woodstock wear does not scream edgy. I feel a trickle of sweat drip down between my shoulder blades. Nice hair, I say. Nash pats his shellac do, making sure it has kept its height through the bus ride. Finding all the follicles in place, he turns his attention to me. He fishes a peppermint lip balm out of his pocket and hands it over. Then he picks three or four of my long brown hairs off my shirt. Nash always grooms me like some fastidious chimpanzee mother. Finally, he straightens the silver charm on its chain around my neck. The charm was Nash's gift to me on the first day of high school. It's this cool spiral, and he says it's to remind me that he's got my back, always. I pretty much never take the thing off. Thanks, I say, when he's done making me presentable. Nash holds out his hand. Did you bring the goods? I dig in my bag and pull out a Ziploc baggie. Inside is one of my signature breakfast bars tailored especially for Nash. Cashews, chunky peanut butter, oats, cinnamon, dried cherries, and a few dark chocolate chips. I know, shocking, right? A fat girl who bakes. So cliche. But I started making these bars for Nash a few years back when his dad left and things went to shit at his house. He was living on ramen noodles and cold cereal, so now the bars are part of our morning routine. I wave the baggie over my head, keeping his breakfast just out of reach. Who loves you, baby? He snatches the bag from my hand and pinches off a corner of the bar, popping it in his mouth. Mmm, his mouth is full. What's different? A little cardamom, fewer cherries. It was too sweet. Well done, Mags. I wait as he chews, looking out the window at the rows of identical cedar split levels lining the streets. It's a decent neighborhood, but it's in between, not new, but not old enough or cool enough to be vintage either. As soon as he finishes breakfast, Nash glances around to see if anyone is listening and leans in close. Check out the hottie in row two. I tilt my head above the back of the seats and catch a glimpse of tousled longish brown hair in the left-hand seat. Ducking back down, I ask, who is it, without letting my lips move. Nash shrugs, and we fan ourselves with our hands. Nash and I have the same taste in almost everything. Teachers, music, art, literature, and boys. The good news is we can mock anyone who doesn't share our aesthetic. The bad news is we have to lay claim to guys we both crush on. There just aren't that many crush-worthy possibilities in Cedar Ridge. Dibs, we say at the same time. Nash narrows his eyes at me. We've been doing the dibs thing since elementary school, but we didn't start using it on boys until 7th grade. It's kind of a running joke with us, this idea that we can have a guy just by claiming him. Never once have any of the crushes reciprocated, but the ritual allows the one with dibs to discuss the object of his or her affection as if romance was a realistic possibility. Okay, I hold my hands up against Nash's world-famous death stare. You can have him. Not a big deal. I'm long past believing in the fairy tale of the handsome stranger who sees past my not-quite-model-esque figure to discover the fabulous Maggie within. After all, that would be some headline. Fat girl snags new guy. I gaze out the window as the bus turns the corner and rolls along the lakefront. The evergreens still cast long shadows a good distance into the lake from the shore, but starting about 30 feet out, the water glitters with early morning sunlight. I steal another glance at the new guy and cross my fingers that Nash has an actual chance with this one. When the bus rolls to a stop in the parking lot, we descend into the bustling fray. The kids who drive start streaming in from the student parking. I link arms with Nash and move in their direction, hoping to blend into the stream and avoid the shame of being bussies. But Nash stops short, which yanks me to a stop. I look up and see new guy. He's a little taller than Nash, with sandy brown hair, tan freckled skin, and these grass-green eyes casting around for something to hold on to. Nash steers us in his direction, and we come to a halt right in front of him. Hi, Nash says. You lost? The new guy just looks at Nash. Nash Taylor, he hooks a thumb in my direction. Maggie Bauer. Welcome to Cedar Ridge, he adds, releasing my arm and giving a little bow. This way. Nash sweeps his arm in front of him, ushering new guy in the direction of the main building. They start to move off, leaving me alone, the current of students flowing around me. I'm not sure if I should follow, but as Nash chats up the new guy, he gives a surreptitious head jerk, the universal sign for get your ass up here. New guy doesn't seem bothered by Nash's bossiness or by Nash leading him around. That fact alone is surprising. Maybe this one will break our losing streak.
Tom, it turns out, has moved around a lot. So how does that affect how he forms relationships?
Well, I think he has come to see himself as a bit of a short timer. So his investment is in the short term. And so he is a charmer. He's learned a lot of really good skills about how to charm people and be friends with people really quick, kind of cut to the chase a little bit. But he also expects to be leaving anytime. And so he doesn't necessarily invest as deeply, and he doesn't expect to be around to pay the consequences if he makes some mistakes or hurts people.
Which comes into play later in the story.
Yes.
In a big way for Maggie. Was it challenging to write a gay male character? I mean, what do you know about that?
Yeah, that actually was one of the most challenging parts about it for me. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that I felt so much pressure to get it right. Because in young adult literature, and I think that's true of all literature in the U.S. anyway, that's a group that's very underrepresented in terms of main characters especially. And so I didn't want Nash to feel like a sidekick, and I didn't want him to feel like a stereotype, and I didn't want any of my characters to feel like that, but it was especially important to me to get Nash right. And it was very intimidating in a lot of ways, because when I was growing up in the 80s, we didn't have people coming out. There was maybe one guy that I knew in high school who actually came out, and it was a very difficult thing for him. But we, you know, now I have a lot of people that I went to high school with that maybe they didn't know at the time, but now they know and they're living great lives and I'm really happy for them. But it was not an experience that I had being a friend with an openly gay person in high school. And yet my daughter went to school where one of her friends who is gay was homecoming king. And so it was a nice thing to be able to sort of find that place in between where Nash could be who he was. But I also didn't want this to be a coming out story for Nash. I didn't feel like that was my story to tell. And so I wanted it to be something where he was already out and where I could show that that those experiences of longing for love and romance and of getting your heart broken are universal. They're not, they don't change whether you're heterosexual, homosexual, whatever. That those experiences are something we all feel as humans. So, but I did a lot of research. I did a lot of talking to young men who had come out, who had had that experience, who had been bullied, who had not been bullied. And so I sort of picked and choose so that Nash's experience would be his own combination of some of those things.
It's interesting that you talk about what Nash would feel. So as you're writing, these characters become very, very real to you.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I do a ridiculous amount of side work on the characters. This is my first novel, so the next ones may be different. But so far, this has been how I've worked. And I have pages and pages and pages of interviews that I've done with all of my characters, writing that never made it into the book, but which help form what is in the book. And so both Nash and Maggie, especially, I have, I want to say, easily 5,000 to 8,000 words of interview where I've asked them questions and had them answer in character, which again, sounds like an absurd thing to do, but it was really just part of the process that I needed to do to get to know these people in a three-dimensional way. Because as I said, other than Maggie, who came to me sort of fully formed, the other characters felt pretty flat for a long time, and I had to find a way to get to know them and things about them that were never going to be in the book, but that would help make them real for me.
So you sit down to a writing session and you, as yourself, type a question to your character and then your character responds.
Yes, exactly, in first person. And so even though the book is in Maggie's first person voice, those character interviews, each of the characters got their own voice for that, which I think helped a lot when it came to writing dialogue as well. I was able to differentiate a little better than I had before I did those interviews and feel how that character would have talked and how they would have said things and how that was different from the other characters. So I know it sounds it sounds absurd, but it really did help me. And I the novel I'm working on now, I've done the same thing with the two main characters. I haven't done it with all of the other characters yet, but and it really is the thing that helps me understand who they are.
Thank you.
listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Chris Dennison about her YA novel, You and Me and Him. If you'd like to hear this program again or share it with a friend, the audio is posted on our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to it on our Facebook and Twitter pages. After a short break, we'll hear about Maggie's cool job and find out what Chris Dennison thinks about writers' groups. Stay with us.
Maggie and her Cedar High School friends are all kind of entangled in romances, as often happens in high school. This one likes that one, and that one likes somebody else who likes somebody else. And Maggie compares it to the mythological snake eating its own tail. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Well, Maggie and Nash have never had, neither of them has ever had a boyfriend. And they both long for it. And so when Tom moves in, they both sort of fall for him. Nash has claim on him because that, according to the culture of their friendship, that's what the dibs means. And so Nash likes Tom, and Tom comes to sort of like Maggie, and Maggie likes Tom, and Stacy, who's another character like and a former friend of Maggie's, likes Tom, and then Maggie's other friend, Cece, likes Nash, even though Cece's a girl and everyone knows Nash is gay. She still has a huge crush on him. And then a friend of Cece's has a crush on her. And so it always seems to me that that's sort of the way of the world, especially in high school, where, you know, there's all of these mini triangles going on and they're all connected to another one. And everyone's looking for the thing they don't have, which I think is part of what you're supposed to do in high school, is sort of look outward and say, what am I missing? What do I need to explore? What do I need to see that I haven't seen yet and done that I haven't done yet? So
Maggie has a big interest in music, and she has a pretty cool after-school job.
Yeah, she works in a record store, which a lot of people say they're going away, but in Spokane, there have been two or three open in the last year. So we're definitely on the vinyl highway in Spokane. And I think I'm a big fan of vinyl. My husband and I listen to vinyl all the time. And so I populated the record store with sort of a guru for Maggie, who's an adult who's not her father or her mother, which I think, you know, most teenagers find somebody like that in their life that they can sort of go to. Maybe it's an older brother or sister, maybe it's a teacher, maybe it's just, you know, somebody else's parent, but most of them find somebody who they can talk to that has a little more life experience than they do to help them with those things that they can't figure out. And so Quinn is her boss at the record store. And I had a lot of fun because, again, I grew up in the 80s, and that's kind of when vinyl stopped getting made and bought by people. And so I got to populate the record store with songs from the 80s and the music I grew up with. And so that was a lot of fun for me, too, to have Maggie interested in that kind of music. I don't know a teenager for whom music isn't important, at least as a way of sort of sorting out some of the stuff that they don't know how to express or talk about, because there's so much, it's such a tumultuous time. And I know when I was a teenager, there was so much music that was able to sort of ease me through some of those rough spots when I didn't know how to say what I thought or felt or even how to process that stuff. And there was always somebody some musician or some song that could help me sort of ease over the rough spots.
Just listening to a song sometimes moves you through an emotion. Mm-hmm. Well, this is not a transformation story. I mean, people change by the end of the book, but Maggie doesn't go from a little bit overweight to svelte and in a different position in the social order. Why was that your choice?
Well, I think going back to what I said earlier about the fact that I wanted this to be a story about somebody who discovered that they were this thing, but not only this thing. And I think in our culture, weight definitely is one of those things that people believe if they can just lose some weight that their whole life will change. And that also then that being overweight is some sort of moral failing. And most of the books, not all, but most of the books that I've read about overweight teenagers are about losing the weight. And I definitely bought into that fantasy when I was a teenager and have as an adult as well. And I know most of my friends have as well. And I wanted to write a story about somebody who doesn't change physically, but comes to understand about themselves that that's only one piece of who they are, and that there's lots of other things that they have to offer the world that has nothing to do with that. And it was certain for me at the beginning that Maggie was not going to lose a pound. I mean, she loses her 4.5 pounds in that first paragraph, but what she was going to do with that, you know, for instance, the relationship with her mother, where her mother wants her to be thinner, and that's something Maggie really struggles with, that idea that her mother only sees her as this overweight girl who needs to lose weight, and then understanding that it would make it harder for her to have this romantic love that she was seeking. And so she comes to understand all that stuff throughout the story. But I think if there is a change in Maggie, then it's that coming to that understanding that that might be something that she changes about herself at some point, but it's not the most important thing about her, and she can live with it, and she'll seek out people who can also live with it. I think Quinn says at one point, to the right person, your dress size won't be any more important than your shoe size. And that, I think, is the kind of person that Maggie wants to spend time with.
Why did you choose a young adult audience?
Well, the story sort of came to me. I was working on another novel that was based on a family story. And as I said, this is my first novel that I've finished. And I was really sort of stuck on that other novel because I didn't have the skill set really to tell the story the way I needed to tell it. And I was talking to my daughter one day, and she was probably 14 at the time. And I was saying, oh, I'm working on this book and I'm kind of stuck, but it doesn't really matter because nobody's ever going to see it anyway, because nobody ever sees your first book, and you know, you have to write a couple books before anyone sees it. And she said, well, that's such a great story. It's a shame you're going to waste it on a book nobody will ever see. And she said, maybe you should write another book as your practice book and then go back to that one when you know more about how to write a book. And I thought, oh, that's a great idea. I'll do that. So I started going back through a notebook I had of ideas, and I found this sentence that said, a girl who works in a record store. It was just a sentence in this little moleskin that I have that I keep ideas in. And so I started thinking about that girl. And after a couple weeks, she started talking to me and she became Maggie. And so I thought, okay, well, I'll do this. I'll write at least a first draft of this book and just sort of teach myself how to write a novel. And to answer your question, I didn't set out to write a YA novel per se. That was the story that came to me, was about a protagonist in that age group. And of course, YA is a difficult thing because you know, what is it really? Is it a marketing designation? Is it a shelf where things get shelved? And why are some books YA and some aren't? I think this is clearly, you know, a YA, but I've certainly gotten feedback from a lot of adults that it resonated with them. So, and then I think about something like Karen Thompson's Age of Miracles, which has a 13-year-old protagonist, and it's all from her point of view, and it's adult literary fiction. So I'm not really sure what makes a book YA or not YA. We all have to, as writers, just decide what are the stories we need to tell and then let somebody else sort out how it gets marketed. So,
right. Well, there's another passage I'd like you to read in the book, if you don't mind.
No. Crushes are serious business to Nash. He has this book of boys he's fallen for. Nobody knows about it but me, and I've only seen it once. It's not a creepy stalker kind of thing. It's actually sort of beautiful and sweet. It's more of a way for Nash to figure out what he likes about his crushes and what he wants when he finally finds a real boyfriend. Once in a while, he'll include a yearbook photo, but most of the time he does a portrait of them from memory. It's amazing what Nash can do with pen and ink. Sometimes we watch those reality shows about tattoo shops. It seems like every other episode, someone's coming in to get a portrait tattoo of someone who's died. Nash could knock every one of them out of the park any day of the week. Anyway, the book doesn't have real names, just nicknames he's given them, though his drawings would be enough to reveal each guy's identity in a heartbeat. But the important part to Nash is what he writes there. He once described it to me as an anatomical study of unrequited love. He starts with what he likes about the guy, then as the crush evolves, he adds to it, until the end, when he writes down why his feelings went away. He says it's a crushology book, a way for him to know himself well enough to be able to identify the real thing when it comes along someday, when the stars align and he finds his match.
Speaking of tattoos, what have you got on your arm?
Well, this is when my daughter left after high school. Her first year, she went to France for a year, and then she's been in London. This is her second year in London. And so she turned 18 and wanted to get a tattoo, and she came to my husband and I and said, I want us all to get a compass on somewhere so that we can all find our way back to each other. So, you know, as an adult, what are you going to say? You know, when your kid says, I want us to all find our way back to each other. So we all chose a different version of a compass and got them, got tattoos that summer. So, and then I have a quote from E.M. Forster. It says, only connect the prose and the passion, live in fragments no longer. It's from Howard's End, which is one of my favorite. He's one of my favorite authors. And then this one is from Ray Bradbury, stuff your eyes with wonder. So it's just one of the things I need to remind myself of on a daily basis.
Much better than a post-it note.
Yes.
It's right there all the time.
Yep.
What else do you want to say?
I guess one of the things I want to say is that I could not have gotten this book written without the writing community in Spokane. It's just been an incredibly supportive community there. My writing group, which includes Shan Ray and Sharma Shields and some of the great people that I know you've interviewed. And I hope that all the writers, you know, anyone who's trying to write, even if they're not trying to publish, find a group of people that can support you and tell you the truth and, you know, give you good feedback and cheerlead for you and all those kinds of things, because I definitely would not have gotten this book written without those people. And I think that community is really, really important for me anyway.
Chris Dennison lives in Spokane, Washington. Look for more information about her at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Also there, you'll find poems and book reviews, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Michael Marsalek, executive producer, Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.